Scary, actually.
Yeah.
You are Google. Thank you, Earl. Yeah, Rob, if you can catch that one. Thank you. All right, let's pick up. We're going to kind of rapidly wrap up chapter 14 and get to 15 and 16 tonight.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that's it. And this is on the web to the world. Yes, that's it. All right. To recap, you know, the past few weeks we've kind of switched gears. John wants us to see a little bit more deeply into what's really going on in the world, that the devil is at war with the people of God. The dragon knows he has been defeated now, that he has been cast down in Revelation's language. He knows his time is short, John tells us. And that all he can do is make war on the woman's children, which is Christians in the world. And to do that, he uses the sea beast and the land beast. We've spent the past couple of weeks talking about them a little bit. The different ways in which Satan works in the world, political power, religious, false religion, economic temptation, the desire for pleasure. The mark of the beast, anyone who does not get the mark of the beast can't buy or sell. You don't get to participate in daily life. And in particular with the land beast, that's the mark of the beast that you're receiving. Especially last week, we talked a bit about the pressure was on the people of God, not so much even deny Jesus. It's to affirm some aspect of what the world says is true or good or right. I mean, that's... remember, they were polytheists. On one level, Rome really didn't, you know, they had a pantheon. Remember, in fact, you can go still see today in Rome. What's the point? What was the point of the pantheon? Literally pan, and it's ironic, it was Rome where they speak Latin, but pantheon's a Greek word. Pan meaning all, theon, theos, God, all gods. It was just kind of a temple to all gods. Polytheists can always squeeze one more in with people they conquer. The issue is you have to worship the ones that they tell you to worship as well as your own God, and Christians can't do that. And that was the challenge for Christians. They really didn't care if you wanted to go do some little weird ritual on Sunday morning. The issue was, are you going to agree that Caesar is Lord, which was kind of their politicized version of politicized religion. And Christians can't say that. Christians can't participate in the worship of the divine emperor. And so the pressure to affirm, which is something, again, that more and more we feel in our culture, is real. And I was thinking, actually, after class last week, and this kind of brings us back, wrapping up the immediate portrait of the beasts and getting into chapter 14, before we go look at the bowls, the seven bowls of wrath. You know, understanding how the world really works, which is part of what Revelation is trying to reveal, at its best feels like sociology and psychology. At their best, at their worst, they're false, and they kind of have visions of what human life or human society ought to be that are wrong, that are sinful. You know, there's plenty of psychologists today that affirm, say, transgenderism as, you know, the right outworking. At their worst, they're false. At their best, though, they do tap into what is true about us. And so we stop and think about that. I was thinking about this after class last weekend. We talked about the land beast, the sea beast, the different forms of power that Satan has in the world, political power to actually persecute force of the government, again, false religion to tempt you. Remember, the land beast looks like a dragon but speaks like a lamb. I mean, you know, that's a very potent image in Revelation's imagery. Think back to 9/11 for a second, and again, how sometimes even, you know, the people we consider to be our enemies in the world, at least in a national sense, they show a deeper understanding of how things really work than we do. 9/11, the attacks of 9/11 centered on two cities. Which two cities were they? That's our version of the land beast and the sea beast. Do you think about that? Sometimes the Muslims see us more truly than we see ourselves. Why attack D.C.? Seat of that's the sea beast. That's the seat of our political power. Why attack New York? Financial and cultural capital of the country. The land beast. That's our version of the land beast. Or where the land beast lives, so to speak. That makes sense? You with me? all three, well, it used to be the three major networks, where are they all based out of? New York City. What's the nation's paper of record? New York Times. New York Times. The old gray lady. Considered the nation's paper of record. Broadway. A lot of culture and cultural ideas either get created there or perpetuated there or take some sort of iconic form there. Yeah. Wall Street. Enough said. You get the idea. Sometimes our enemies see us more clearly than we, as Christians, unfortunately, see the world for what it really is. We are kind of like Jesus' disciples sometimes. We go to New York, and like the disciples in Matthew 24, when they walked into Jerusalem and saw the temple, they say, wow, Jesus, look at this. Isn't this cool? And what does Jesus say to the disciples about their city, Jerusalem, and their temple? You see an impressive building. What I see is the work of the devil, and they'll all be destroyed. And sometimes we as Christians can't look at our own cities and recognize, for all their impressiveness of the skyscrapers and the buildings and the culture and everything else, what does God see when he looks at New York City? What does God see when he looks at Washington, D.C.? Yeah, I mean, I see the Smithsonian and, you know, and the National Mall. And what does God see when he looks at? He sees Babylon. Yeah. And so sometimes, I'm not saying don't take your next family vacation to New York and go to Broadway or something, though you might think about it. But you get my point. I mean, I think sometimes we as Christians, isn't it ironic? Osama bin Laden saw in one sense more clearly when he chose his targets where the seat of our beasts are, that even God's people in this country can see with clarity. That's why Revelation is a revealing. It is an uncovering. It is an unveiling if you have eyes to see. If you want to learn to see the world the way God sees it, in your time, your place. So, all right. So, with that strong warning, chapter 14 kind of wraps up with the angels flying through heaven. And in particular, the third angel, for our purposes, verse 9 there. I think this is really where we stopped last week. And it's a warning. It's not for people in the world. It's for the people of God. If anyone worships the beast in its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath. It won't just be those people of the world. The people of God who in some way compromise with the world, in some way affirm or participate in a way that marks you as part of the world. And again, part of what this book's trying to unveil is it's easier to do that than you realize. We're not talking about denying Jesus. We're talking about participating in the world. And it's easier to do that in the way that God considers you marked by the beast than we realize. And if anyone receives a mark on his forehead or forehand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of his name, in certain parentheses, including Christians. So here is the call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. All right, then the last image is an image of harvest. We looked at that a little bit last week. Brings us to chapter 15. So with all this said, the last cycle of seven in the book, seven bowls of wrath. And we're going to move quickly for sake of time because the quarter is starting to wind down and we've still got a third of the book to go. I heard that. the chuckles in the back. So I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues. And that's an intentional word. When you hear that word plague, what do you think of? You think of Egypt. And why would God choose that kind of imagery and that kind of language? And by the way, when you read about the seven bowls, they sound an awful lot like various of the plagues that God unleashed on Egypt. Why would God use that kind of imagery here? Calling his people out. This is God's, remember going back earlier in the book, what's the question that drives the book? Yeah, the souls under the altar asking God, how long till you do something about what they're doing to us on earth? And so that's the outcry. How does the book of Exodus begin back in chapter 1? There's an outcry to God as Pharaoh does what? Oppresses his people and tries to destroy them, tries to end the covenant people of God. and there's an outcry to heaven. And what's God's answer? Moses, and what comes with Moses? Plagues. And so we are meant to see ourselves as living in a world that is globally Egypt. And just like Pharaoh tries to destroy Israel, the world will still try to destroy the people of God. It's always Egypt. It's always Babylon. We've seen how the Revelation uses these different cities and places. And so God brings, in the imagery of Revelation, brings plagues again. And what happens at the end of the plagues in the book of Exodus? What happens? God's people are delivered. And Egypt is... Even as Pharaoh's own servants say at one point in the middle of the plagues, and as Pharaoh's hardening his heart, don't you know Egypt is, and remember what their word is? Egypt is destroyed. Let them go, Pharaoh. Their God has destroyed us. Let them go. And so seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last, for with them the wrath of God is finished. This is meant to see as a wrapping up, as a bringing of the plot of the book to an end. And so I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, which takes us back to the beginning of the book, the imagery of the book, chapter 4, when John first sees the throne of God, and what's it surrounded by? This sea of glass. And so we're back there again. A sea of glass mingled with fire, and also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name. Hear that? They didn't get the mark. Instead, those who have died in the Lord, who have endured, and now they are at rest and with God. They conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name. That's the 666. Standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sing the song of Moses and the servant of God. What's the song of Moses referring to?
Victory.
Yeah. When does it happen? Yeah, and where are they in Exodus 15? Actually, the text makes it explicit. It's Exodus 15. And where are they when they sing that song? They are by the sea. By the sea that God has parted to bring them through. And they sing the song that is the song of their deliverance. God has overthrown the chariot and its rider. And they sing the song of Moses by the sea. And what do we see now here in Revelation? By the true sea, so to speak. Singing the song of Moses, but not just Moses anymore. And the song of the true Moses. The one who brings ultimate deliverance for all of God's people of all times and all places. Not just from some physical suffering in the world, but from the oppression of the true Pharaoh, the true emperor, the true evil leader. Who's against God's people? Satan himself. And so they sing the song. See, I told you, all the Dunsmores aren't here this week. They're singing after all. It's so dark, so long, but finally they're singing. Great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. And after this I looked, and the sanctuary of the tent of witness in heaven was opened. And out of the sanctuary came the seven angels with the seven plagues, clothed in pure bright linen, golden sashes around their chests. And one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels. And who are the four living creatures? We've seen them before too. Who are these guys? Cherubim, yeah. See them in the book of Ezekiel, see them actually back in Genesis chapter 3. They're the ones that literally, it's not just angels guard the Garden of Eden, it's cherubim. They're the ones who dwell closest to God's presence. I call them God's secret service. They carry his throne chariot. They stand closest to his throne. They're called living creatures because they have faces of all kinds of different living things. God is life. And the beings who stand closest to him are the embodiments of all the different specific forms of life that God creates and manifests in creation. And they, that's right, and they do various... Mm-hmm. Yep, they're part of that, all of that. And so from all those four living creatures from the throne of God, they're given seven bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And the sanctuary was filled with smoke from the glory of God and his power. And no one could enter the sanctuary until the plagues were finished. And so I heard a loud voice from the temple telling the seven angels, go and pour out on the earth seven bowls of the wrath of God. And so the first angel went and poured out his bowl on the earth. Harmful and painful sores came upon the people who bore the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. Just like in Exodus, did the plagues affect Israel or did they affect the Egyptians? They affected the Egyptians. And so who gets the disaster of this first bowl? Those who bear the mark of the beast. Remember in the Revelation, everybody gets a mark, right? You're either marked by God or you're marked by the beast. Everybody gets a mark. Second angel poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became like the blood of a corpse, and every living thing died that was in the sea. What does that remind you of? Yeah. Third angel poured out his bowl into the rivers and springs of water, and they became blood. And I heard the angel in charge of the waters say, "Just are you, O Holy One, who is and who was, for you brought these judgments." Why is this happening? It goes back to the originating question issue back early in the book. "For they have shed the blood of the saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink." It's what they deserve. I turn your water into blood because you made my saints' blood run. It's what you... And again, there's that phrase that makes us uncomfortable because we're more righteous than God sometimes. Vengeance, oh, you got to forgive and forget. Yes and no. You forgive the wrongs people do you. It's not justice to forgive the wrongs that people do against others in their name. That's not justice. Does that make sense? Jesus, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." Did God actually forgive those who did that to them, though? Did God actually forgive those who crucified Jesus? No. What's Jesus doing in that moment? We miss this important nuance sometimes about what the way forgiveness and justice work. Jesus releases the personal wrong that has been done to him personally. But is their sin bigger than just what they've done against Jesus personally? Is it rebellion against God? Is it a rejection of his will and ways? Does that deeper sin not bear ill fruit in other directions, lead others astray, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah, and so in that sense, they're not forgiven just because Jesus wishes that. And we need to understand that sometimes. Forgiveness is about releasing the debt personally the grievance that I have against someone they've done me wrong. But forgiveness is not releasing God's legitimate claim of justice against those who have done me wrong. In other words, I can say when somebody does me wrong, Father, forgive them. But the fact of the matter is that they still owe, because all sin is ultimately against God, they still owe a debt to God that's not mine to give away. Well, there's something to that, yeah. I don't want to go too far down the nuance. But we get uncomfortable with the fact that here's that in the verse 6, it's what they deserve. It's what they deserve. And I heard the altar. Remember, who's the altar? The voice coming from the altar? It's the saints. Remember, we met in the fifth seal. And I heard on the altar saying, "Yes, Lord God, the Almighty, true and just are your judgments." Finally, we get our vengeance. And the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and it was allowed to scorch people with fire, and they were scorched with fierce heat. And they cursed the name of God who had the power of these plagues. But notice the next sentence. This is important. And they removed their repentance because they feared God, finally realizing his great power. Is that what happened? What happened?
Just like Pharaoh.
Just like Pharaoh. And this is just like from Exodus, literally from the beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible. Never forget this. The way God runs the world is to draw out of us what we really are and put on display before heaven and earth the truth about us. Pharaoh hardens, going back to Pharaoh, he hardens his own heart before the Bible ever talks about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. The idea is he's made his choice, and now what God does is God puts him in positions that draw out what God knows he's already determined in his heart. And so God runs the rest of the world, and so, by the way, God runs you and I's lives. So, again, let the reader understand. This is what God does. All sorts of revealing going on in this book, and the world collectively is revealed for what it is, and it's literal, damnable, stubborn rebelliousness that will not, under any judgment of God, finally bow the knee and admit God is right and they're wrong. They did not repent and give him glory. Fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. People gnawed their tongues in anguish, and again they cursed the God of heaven for their pain and their swords, and they did not repent of their deeds. You get the sense that this is getting more intense the further we go. People are getting angrier the further we go. I mean, first couple of bowls, we're not really told their reaction. Now every bowl, what are we being told? They curse God. They do not repent. It's getting more intense the deeper we go into this cycle. What's one of the other things compared to the other cycles of seven that we've seen so far, the seals and the trumpets? What's one of the other differences, by the way? Has anybody noticed it yet in this cycle of seven? Earlier it was a fourth, and then it was a third, and now it's everything. Because this is coming to the end, God's end game. God's end game. And the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings of the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophets, three unclean spirits like frogs. This is the unholy trinity. If God is Father, Son, and Spirit, here you have dragon and his two henchmen, the sea beast and the land beast. For they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for the battle on the great day of the God Almighty. Stop there for a sec. A fascinating kind of penultimate scene. The sixth bowl is basically, in a sense, gathering the world in a war of all against all. That culminates in going from a war of all against all to collectively war against God, and the seventh bowl will be the end when God, just blows the whole thing up. The sixth bowl is fascinating. So here's the thing. A lot going on in the imagery of this one. We've kind of plowed through quickly. You get the idea. It gets worse and worse. People get angrier and angrier. First of all, the idea that, we kind of think of, and you want, there's a temptation almost here in Revelation up to this point, it's kind of, the world against God. But part of the way Satan runs the world, his influence in the world, is not just a unifying of the human race rebelling against God, but part of his, destructiveness is turning everybody against each other. And so the truth of the matter is, as you go through history, and where does the imagery of, why are we using beasts to describe all this at all? Probably goes all the way back to the book of Daniel, right? When God first shows Daniel visions of coming empires in Daniel chapter 7, and what's each empire represented by? It's represented by a beast of some sort. A beast of some sort. And which, again, is kind of potent. In fact, going back a sec, go back to Daniel. The vision of the four coming empires happens twice in Daniel. First time it happens is in chapter 2 when Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Y'all remember the story? Some of you teach, ladies, you teach Bible classes. Maybe you've done this more recently with the kids' classes. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of a statue made out of four different metals. And nobody can figure out what it means. And Daniel, that's when Daniel first kind of, gets his credentials, because he shows up and not only knows what the dream was, but what it means. And it's a series of successive coming empires. But what's important is it was Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And when it was Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and remember by chapter 4, we realize he's a pretty cocky, arrogant man. This is not Babylon, Babylon the Great that I have built, right? Remember Nebuchadnezzar? He's very, very into this. Does not learn the lesson of the dream, because four metals mean that, is Babylon the last empire of the human race? No, there's going to be others. And so for Nebuchadnezzar, the message ought to lead to one of humility. You're not the greatest and the best. You may be the head of gold, but there's a whole lot more underneath that that's coming. You're not the end of history. You're not the climax of history. What does Nebuchadnezzar turn around and do very next chapter? You ever thought about this, the connection between the stories? What does Nebuchadnezzar do the very next chapter? No, he doesn't get humbled yet. He builds a statue, but all of one metal. Which one? And what does he then require everybody to do? Bow down to my empire. Bow down, thanks for the heads up, Daniel. I appreciate the warning that there may be other empires. We're going to make sure that doesn't happen. Yeah, let's have a loyalty test. Let's make sure there's no weakness in my administration. Let's have a loyalty test. Let's get everybody worshiping one image of gold. And by chapter 4, is this not Babylon, Babylon the Great that I, he's not listening to the vision at all. And that's when God, to your point, Earl, humbles him. But it's interesting. So when Nebuchadnezzar has the vision, it's of an image that looks kind of nice with beautiful metals. When God gives Daniel God's own vision, a version of that coming reality, what's the image that God chooses? Because how does God actually see? Again, we always see the shining buildings and the great achievements, We see an image of metals, precious metals. What does God see when he looks at what we do? We reduce ourselves to animals. We're just beasts. We have forfeited the image and glory of God that we were created to bear and what we do and who we are. And so the simple fact, going back to Daniel, one of the source places of much of the imagery of Revelation, the beasts, that's what we are. And that's how the dragon works in the world, is through these beasts. The beasts turn on each other sometimes. You know, what happens to the lion? You know, that starts in the vision of Daniel chapter 7. What happens to that lion? Well, he's destroyed by the bear, which represents Persia, right? The beasts turn on each other over time. And there's actually, in fact, keep your finger here. Don't worry, Diana, it's not Colossians. go with me to the book of Daniel, though, real quick, actually show you something. That's kind of just to get your mind around the complexity of how the world works, especially when God starts pulling back the veil a little bit here and there. I think in the book of Daniel, I want to pick up in Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10. Let's see. Chapter 10, verse 1, the vision is dated in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And the word was true, and it was a great conflict. You know, Daniel showed kind of the scariness of what's coming in history. Verse 7, and I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great trembling fell on them, so they fled to hide themselves. Just so not like touched by an angel back on CBS. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, and no strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed. I retained no strength, and I heard the sound of the being's words. And I heard the sound of my words, I heard the sound of his words, and I fell on my face in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. And behold, a man touched me, set me trembling on my hands and knees, said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word, I stood up trembling, and he said to me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and have humbled yourself before God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. We've come in this passage before in this class, but again, I want to come back to it again, because here's the thing, and you're given just a tidbit of it here. It's weird, raises as many questions as it provides answers, but it's a revelation moment. It's a moment when briefly the veil is pulled back, and the unseen realm, which is just as real as the seen realm, and impacts what happens in the seen realm and vice versa. And Daniel is allowed to be have that experience for a moment, so to speak. The angel that comes to Daniel to reveal the coming, more of the coming history, which includes the downfall of Persia. But who holds up the spiritual being from coming more quickly for 21 days, 3 weeks? What he calls the prince of Persia, the spiritual being that represents Persia. In the Bible, long story for another time, goes all the way back to the book of Deuteronomy, little weird verses we don't read, and kind of corners of various books and prophets. One of these Old Testament seems to teach is the idea that in the unseen realm, nations are kind of represented by angels before God. Michael is the prince of your people. Michael the archangel is God, is Israel's angel in heaven, so to speak. Why would the prince of Persia hold up a spiritual being coming to tell Daniel about the downfall of Persia? Because Persia doesn't want to fall. Just like Babylon didn't want to fall. When Nebuchadnezzar's told there's going to be other empires, what does Nebuchadnezzar do? Nah, won't be other empires. We're going to, now that I've been warned that it could happen, we're going to work all the harder, loyalty tests and bow down to images and all that. We're going to work all the harder to make sure it doesn't happen. And it's not just, it's earthly rulers who get that way. And how the line works, the Bible never explains, but the evil spiritual beings are involved in this as well. The spiritual being that represents Persia doesn't want a message brought about the fall of Persia. All that to say, what in the world's going on then? Even within the satanic realm, whatever beast is dominant, so to speak, it has its own enemies among the demonic and the satanic. Because it's a war of all against all. Satan doesn't build community and stability and order. What does Satan build? Satan builds chaos. Yeah, is that your word? Great word for it. Builds chaos. Builds death and destruction and decay. God is the one who establishes order and hierarchy and structure. What Satan does is literally brings devolution and decreation, uncreation. Things fall apart. It doesn't, you know, it's fascinating. Every paradise lost, you know, Milton's Satan kind of, you know, builds pandemonium, you know, kind of the city of demons and hell. And the demons all kind of work together, you know, yes, we can. That's not, in a sense, what the Bible actually depicts. Yes, there are demons, you know, Satan and all of that. But it doesn't bring some sort of chaos or, you know the demonic can get organized and has their different ranks and everything. That's not the picture. So all that going back to the sixth bowl. Sixth angel poured out the bowl in the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Originally, Revelation is meant to primarily deal with the fall of Rome and the Roman Empire. And one of Rome's greatest boundaries that never got passed was the Euphrates River. You can go back and you can read Herodotus. Herodotus tells stories of early Rome, back in the days of the Roman Republic before the Empire, but Roman generals trying to push east, and it doesn't end well. The Euphrates kind of became the boundary of how far Rome could push to the east. And eventually, there was a people there called the Parthians. Romans were never able to subdue them. And eventually, the Parthians begin to push back on the east as Rome's power, after its climax, after its apex, after Rome's power begins to weaken. And so, again, you know, even among, you know, those who don't follow God, others who don't follow God, you know, anybody wants to replace the beast if they can. I mean, that's what you want, right? Coups and assassinations. And so that's the image here, is of the beast itself, kind of other beasts turn on the beast. And what that ultimately leads to is not just kind of Rome's own beginning to contract. It's beginning to crumble. And by the way, other empires feel that way as well. Technically, when Persia pushed down Babylon, Persia was technically to the north and east. The Medes kind of came more from the north, and the great Persian capitals of Ecbatana, of Susa, were to the east of Babylon. And so that was always kind of in the Bible. It's always kind of been the bad stuff comes from the east when somebody falls. And that's, again, that thought world, that imagery is what's tapped into here. And yes, sir. Sure.
Corporate America, everybody stab each other in the back to get them stopped.
Yeah, that's right. Same imagery. That's right. Because when your ultimate God, no matter what particular name you put on or whatever temple you go and worship at, when your ultimate God is self, power and pleasure and self-fulfillment, then it's always next man up if you can. But the other thing, then, besides the fact that what he sees here is kind of, you know, the God, you know, God allows other peoples to begin to beat down Rome. I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. They are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of the Almighty. And so, words of deceit. What kind of words of deceit? Well, okay, you know, so yes, maybe one empire is passing away, but the next one will be better and different. I mean, you remember, well, what was Hitler's rhetoric? It was the Third Reich, and it was going to last, 1,000 years. How'd that work out? But everybody, when they're you know, kind of, you know, nipping and beating down the previous empire, what's every up and coming empire and new power think that they're going to be? The one who's better and different. Where does that foolish deceit come from? According to Revelation, it comes from Satan himself, that the next worldly ruler will be the guy to build the imperial eternal city. And so it goes. And that's why the cycle keeps on repeating itself. Yes, by originally Revelation is written to Christians about the end of Rome, but the cycle keeps on repeating itself until Jesus comes back. There will be other beasts. We're a beast. We've talked about that already this quarter. We're a beast. If the world speaks your language, uses your money, wants to do business with you, and fears your military power, you're the beast. It's that simple. And And so, you know, that's the cycle keeps on repeating itself. And why? Because the dragon, the land beast, and the false prophet, the dragon, the sea beast, and the land beast, the false prophet, they keep on speaking the same lies, and people keep on, in every generation, falling for the same idea. This time it will be different or better. And ultimately, what it does culminate is it does culminate in some sort of, you know, in one sense, the spirit of ultimate human rebellion. All nations gathered together in rebellion against God, even as they fight amongst themselves. And they assembled them at the place that in Hebrew is called, and in English it's written in your Bible, Armageddon with an A. It's actually in Greek, there's an H, or well, it's a rough breathing mark. Greek doesn't have an H, Harmageddon. Because the word itself is not Greek. The word itself is the Hellenization of Hebrew. Har Megiddo, Mount Megiddo. Har in Hebrew means mount or mountain. And Megiddo is Megiddo, Megiddon, Megiddo. It's a symbol. It's not a literal place. The Battle of Armageddon, it's a symbol. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, the city of Megiddo was an important city because it guarded a plain, the plain of Jezreel. And that plain was one of the key choke points. You know, we live in Houston. We're used to a flat kind of place. Most of the world is not flat. And so you have to actually, your roads and everything are determined by where the hills and the valleys are. And here's your Sea of Galilee. And you had Megiddo up here to the north. And the Valley of Jezreel here, and you had the Carmel Mountains kind of run like a finger like here towards Haifa, and so you had, and then you had the highlands here, and so Megiddo controlled a pass between a couple of high mountainous areas, not mountains by Rocky Mountain standards, but by there, you know, you're not going to bring chariots through kind of place, you know, a couple thousand, 3,000, 4,000 feet elevation. The city of Megiddo was important because it controlled that pass. And so throughout Israel's history, sometimes the reason certain places have a lot of battles is because of geography. First time you meet this place, Book of Judges chapter 5, remember with Jabin, one of the kings of the Canaanite cities, and Deborah and Barak and Jael and Sisera, remember that great story? Go back and read in Judges 5, it happens here around Megiddo. And the reason it happens there is because the Canaanites could use their chariots in that area because it's an open flat plain. Why is it called Mount Megiddo? Because cities, as they're destroyed over the centuries, they just rebuild on the same thing. And so you know what happens to cities over time? They become mounds. And so I've been to Megiddo. It's actually pretty cool. Been there, it does. It looks out over the valley, and it is a man-made mound now because it's been rebuilt and destroyed so many times. But why do people keep on putting cities there over the millennia? Because you need a fort or some sort of place to control this crucial military pass. You can't get into the heartland, the coastal plain of Israel, if you can't bring your army or whatnot through here. And so other places in which climactic battles were fought. This is where Josiah died. Why did Josiah choose to attack Pharaoh Necho and the Egyptians who were passing through? And why were the Egyptians even passing through there? Because they had to bring their army and their chariots through that plain. And that's where Josiah chose to try to take them on and defeat them. And what happened to Josiah? He dies. So anyways, everybody understood that Megiddo was the place of climactic battles. By the way, as recently as World War I, there was a significant engagement fought in that area between the Turks and the British and some other powers there in the context of World War I. Just because geography determines where certain important places are. And so it's simply what they would have understood as a place of climactic battle. Were crucial battles where literally armies, invasions are made or broken. To control Megiddo, to get through Megiddo is to successfully invade the land. And vice versa, you know. And so in Josiah's case, Necho won and Necho kept going. And Egypt, you know, that was kind of the beginning of the individual's power, by the way, because after Josiah died, four relatively weak kings afterwards, and they were destroyed in 586. Three of Josiah's sons and one grandson. And none of them were very capable kings, and Nebuchadnezzar made a hash of all of them and took over. The death of Josiah, the loss of control of that area was the end. Yes, ma'am.
Is this referred to as the King's Highway, or is that a trade route?
There was a road called the King's Highway. Yeah, King's Highway. Yeah, in fact, some Bible maps, there were several key roads. There was one that ran right along this side of the Jordan and kind of went out towards the Arabah. There was a highway that ran all the way down. You kind of connected in here that took you down to Egypt. Again, that's why Necho was coming up that way, because he was on, we forget this, Necho was on his way to, actually, and he makes this point to Josiah when Josiah comes out to fight him. Yes, I'm passing through your land, but I'm not here to invade you. I'm on my way to go fight the Assyrians, is actually where Necho was on his way. But to get up here to fight, you know, fight the Assyrians, he had to bring his army through. But Josiah liked the Assyrians at that point. The reason Josiah did not want Necho to help fight the Assyrians was because if the Assyrians fell, Josiah was smart enough to realize Babylon becomes a real power and a real threat to us. There really was some geopolitics going on. Whereas if the Babylonians have to keep on fighting against the Assyrians rather than Necho going and joining with the Babylonians to destroy the Assyrians, which is in fact what happened, we kind of have a buffer against the Babylonians is what Josiah understood. The Bible didn't talk about that, but it makes sense in terms of the politics of what was going on. So that's why Josiah actually, he wasn't really worried about Necho invading him. He did not want to see Assyria completely fall. They made a nice buffer against Babylon. Josiah could see the handwriting on the wall. You always want buffer states, man. You always want buffer states. In the Ukraine, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. It gets complicated, and there are deep reasons for why nations do what they do. All right, so they assemble a place called Armageddon. And then the seventh bowl is poured out. A loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, "It is done." And there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a great earthquake such as there had never been since man was on the earth. So great was that earthquake. And the great city was split in three parts. The cities of the nations fell. Catch the language there in verse 19. It's important. The great city was split into three parts, and the cities, plural, of the nations fell. And God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. What's going on there, great city versus cities? Y'all catch what he's doing there in terms of imagery? Don't think too literally. Think in terms of imagery. This is the book of images. The city, in one sense, represents what? The great city. Huh?
The rebellious.
Yeah, I mean, they're all rebellious. The great city is just the idea of kind of the cumulative human efforts of the human race. It's Babel. You know, in Genesis 11, the whole human race comes together. We can do that with all being in the same place. Man can have his various cities, and yet we still all function as one great city of rebellion. Does that make sense? You with me? Particular cities are going to fall, but the great city itself represents humanity collectively in its rebellion. You with me? And the great city can be a literal place, a city of cities. It can be the New York City / Washington, D.C. of an era. It can be the Rome of another era. It can be the London of another era. It can be the literal Babylon of a particular era. It can be the Nineveh of an era, and so forth, where there do seem to be some cities, even among men within history, that are dominant. But I think what John and what Revelation are getting at here is the great city is humanity collectively is broken. Our cumulative, accumulated efforts. It's the ancient version of globalization. And it's dealt with even as our particular cities crumble. And great hailstones fell, and God made Babylon drink the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. And creation fled away. No mountains are to be found. And they cursed God for the plague of the hail because the plague was so severe. Even on the cusp of death and hell, the truly godless and rebellious will still curse God. As C.S. Lewis once put it I think it was in The Great Divorce, the door to hell is locked from the inside. That is, that there's a sense in which those who are lost are so given to their rebelliousness against God, they would choose hell even knowingly rather than confess to God. They get to that point in their depravity and their hardness and their rebelliousness. And even at this moment of ultimate end, people cursed God because the plague was so severe. And so you have here an image of the end of Rome, the end of the world. The end is the end. For Rome, it was the end of the world as they knew it. you either literally died, you know, or just, you know, the world as you knew is not going to be the same anymore. It's the end of the world. And eventually, at some point, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be an end, capital E, to it all. God only knows when that's going to be. But the cycles will keep on repeating themselves, whether it's Babylon in the Old Testament, Rome in the New, etc., United States at some point in the future. The cycle will keep on happening, and this is what it looks like. This is how God works. What happens in chapter 17, this gets us to where we need to be for next week, 17 and 18. And I encourage you to read chapter 18 in particular this week soberly, and just think about, again, how God works in history. What happens then, just to kind of give us a teaser, chapter 17, verse 1, so one of the angels who had the seven bowls, you know, they dump it out, God's judgment comes in Egypt-style plagues that break the world and deliver God's people, ultimately. And one of those angels in the aftermath of all that says, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. Now stop right there for a second. The prostitute we're about to meet is another depiction of the world's allure. Of the world's allure. And the fact that he mentions sexual immorality, but he calls kind of the world embodied a prostitute, implies that he's not just literally condemning specific sexual sin, though, I mean, that's obviously wrong. But remember in the Bible, and we've talked about this before in this quarter, but this chapter 17 and chapter 18 really brings this out now. And the language of Revelation, sexual immorality is you know, fornicating with the prostitute. Fornicating with the prostitute, she's a symbol. You don't literally, you know, sexual sin, sure, you'll go to hell for that. But you don't fornicate literally with a symbol. How do you fornicate with her? It's the spiritual involvement of yourself with her. The joining of yourself to her, what she represents and what she is. It's another way of getting at, you know, the mark of the beast, of affirming what the world is participating in, and even valuing what the world values. When your heart is not guarded, you begin to love the world and the things of the world. She represents the pleasure of the world. And not all of it is immediately immoral in of itself. This is where I think Christians today, we have to be oh so careful. Because as you read chapter 18, I mean, you know, some of what she traffics in is not sinful in of itself. But it's sinful, it becomes part of the world and the system that she is. And so often as Christians, the problem we have sometimes, we sit there and say, well, there's nothing wrong with, and fill in the blank. You know, there's nothing sinful about having money and a lot of, you know, and being comfortable being rich. And yet, what does Jesus say? He says the love of money, but what else does he say? It's hard what? Easier for a camel. In other words, because it doesn't just stay money neutral in of itself, does it? Not when the human heart gets involved. What does it become? It becomes something we fornicate with, spiritual adultery. It becomes the prostitute's price. Yes, there's technically nothing, you know, Abraham was a rich man. Daniel was a rich man. Okay. But rare was the man who could handle that and not become involved with the prostitute. And so too here, especially as we go through chapter 17 and 18 next week, do we need to be troubled by, again, how easy it is not just to get the mark of the beast, but to fornicate with the woman? Because there are things in chapter 18 that aren't sinful to have or do in themselves, but often they bring us, it's just like literally for those of us who are married, it's like literally, there's technically nothing sinful with me being alone with a woman who's not my wife. It's not technically sinful. It's foolish. And yes, maybe the first time or the second time I don't commit adultery. But eventually you do that long enough, what happens? And so too with the things that aren't technically wrong, but work themselves into a system of pleasure and comfort and ease. We just want to be comfortable Christians in this life without any consequence, without any suffering. And that's the problem, is when you begin to do that, you're beginning to sleep with the prostitute. The way of Christianity is the way of the cross and conflict with the world. And Jesus warned us, you know, when that, beware when all people speak well of you. And so anyways, yeah, it's a troubling picture, chapter 17, chapter 18. And so we'll pick up there next week. Strong, because again, remember, the book is ultimately meant to warn Christians. It wasn't sent to the world. It was sent to seven churches in Asia to warn them, to reveal to them what's really going on, to reveal to them the nature of the temptation that they are facing, and warn them not to participate in it because judgment is coming. Don't get enamored with the shiny buildings and the Dow Jones being up or being down or whatever. Don't be impressed with the military power. Don't be impressed with the museums. God's not, and we shouldn't be either. All right, God willing, see you next week.